The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hi, I'm Annemarie Cox, and welcome to The Churn, the podcast for people who like interplanetary conflict and the precautionary principle. Like I said, I am Annemarie Cox. I am a political writer by day. I have a podcast called With Friends Like These on the Crooked Media Network. But I'm here today to talk about The Expanse with my co-host, Dan Dresner. Dan, hello.
Hello, Anna. How are you?
Who are you, Dan?
That's a good question. There are many cells contained within me, but for the purposes of this podcast, I'm a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I write spoiler alerts for The Washington Post. I am the author of a book called Theories of International Politics and Zombies, and I'm the author of a forthcoming book called Toddler in Chief.
All right. We've established our bona fides. Now, let us dive into the entirety of The Expanse Season 4. Or at least, I should say, the inners portion. It would take far too long to do everything. We're going to divide this into two parts, the inners and the belters. Dan, where would you like to begin?
I think we should begin with Mars. Mars is a slightly simpler plot, even though it contains, as you have expertly dubbed it, the Breaking Bobby arc.
It is one of our favorites because we both love Bobby, but it is pretty self-contained. I will note, this is not a spoiler alert, it's more like a heads-up thing, that although this season the Mars plotline is self-contained, it sets up other plotlines that will involve Earthers, Belters, colonists, all of that. It's sneakily important. It seems like it's just a story of Bobby, but it's actually pretty important to the whole universe of The Expanse. Tell us about that plotline, Dan.
So the plotline is actually relatively simple, which is we open season four with Bobby no longer in the Martian Marines, clearly suffering the after effects of, you know, killing one of her own Martians inside the ring. She's basically working in a scrapyard and trying to deal with the decommissioning of some of the Martian ships, because there is, after all, now a peace accord between the inners, between Earth and Mars. And yet Bobby keeps running into problems, which is that first she has to rescue her nephew, who is apparently caught up in some criming, helping to make illicit focus drugs that are being sold in the black market. Bobby intervenes in her typical badass Bobby fashion. But in the process, the head criming guy, name is Isai, decides that Bobby owes him for damage to equipment and to various hench people. So in the end, Bobby tries every which way possible to do the right thing here. She tries reporting this to the Martian police, at which point she finds out that Isai, the head criming guy, is also a cop. She tries to report what she's been asked to do to the foreman in her dockyard. The foreman suggests, why can't we do more criming? Which is very frustrating to Bobby. In the end, Bobby decides if she's going to go criming, she's going to go all the way criming. So she winds up quitting her job. She agrees to work for Isai full time. They engage in various kinds of crime in terms of taking the decommissioned equipment and selling them illicitly to questionable sources. This merits Bobby a fair amount of income, so she stays in what seems like a swanky Martian hotel, although by Earth standards, it's like a swanky, tiny little Manhattan hotel room.
With her boy toy.
Yes, Bobby gets some. Good for her. This all comes to a head in essentially the last big score that Isai suggests, which is apparently too easy. It's literally like they don't even have to steal something. All they have to do is take the stolen cargo and move it from point A to point B. It is literally the too good to be true crime. Bobby suspects it. She says she doesn't want to get involved. She quickly susses out that it's a trap, intercedes, but does not prevent the killing of Isai, the crime guy. However, does save the character known in the show as Lily, who Anna and I have dubbed Manic Pixie Crime Girl. Then at the very end of the season, she sends a message to Avasarala on Earth, basically saying there is something rotten on Mars and I want to work with you, which helps to amend something that had happened in a previous episode in which she had been invited to a dinner that Avasarala was there. It was sort of a state dinner because she was visiting Mars and was essentially used as a political pawn by Avasarala, which she resented very greatly.
That was lovely, Dan.
Thank you.
I think that the first question I have is a question that was brought to us on Twitter, which I'm going to paraphrase as, how did Mars get fucked up so fast? Get fucked up so badly so fast? Because the image we have of Mars, because we're dropped into Mars this season.
It's the first time we've seen Mars's inner workings, for lack of a better way.
Right. But we've heard a lot about Mars. Like, we've heard about the stereotypes of Martians. We've heard from Martians about how they feel about Mars. And the image we've gotten, I think, is Spartan in the classical sense of the word, not the sparse sense of the word, right? It's a military society or a martial society.
It's a unified society.
And even if you aren't in the military, there is a great sense of purpose, everyone moving towards this generational project of terraforming Mars. I think, as I've noted before, I think an important background point about Mars, it was settled largely by Texans. So people who know Texans, I think that it's pretty easy to sort of transplant the Texan frame of mind onto Mars, although there's also Southeast Asian, Pacific Islanders, people displaced by climate change, basically. But the Texas thing is important. I mean, it's a frontier town, too. But they've – no, I shouldn't say that. It's not a frontier town.
No, it really isn't.
Yeah,
not at this point in particular.
It's Texan in the sense of its independence.
Yeah.
And
it's swagger
it's
also.
It's swagger. Yes, yes. And we've just gotten the idea they run, as it were, a very tight ship, not just in space but also on the planet. And then we get dropped down onto the planet for the first time. And I think already there's some disconnect between what we've heard about Mars and how we're seeing it, which is that it's a little run down around the edges. There's a literal disconnect in some ways between the ads that run everywhere, which are about joining the Martian Marines, and then hearing from characters that they're disbanding a lot of their Marine Corps.
So I would say a few things on this. The first is one of my favorite parts of this season, particularly when they dealt with Mars. And it, you know, we've talked about this before, and I really do like this point you make about the sort of almost belter ethos of the makers of the Expanse, which is they're not wasting anything. And one of the things they do, particularly on Mars, in a very effective way, because it's almost entirely background stuff, is just showing the sort of world of Mars that we're seeing in terms of like the backdrop of like ads, you know, like that are almost like an ESPN Zone kind of restaurant or bar, or like, you know, the basic culture that Mars is trying to instill, which is this notion of everyone pulling in the same direction. And that's what causes Mars to succeed. And by the way, I would suggest that is also the answer for why Mars is not so much falling apart so fast, but rather why isn't Mars's government reacting? And I think the answer is that if you look at from the Martian government's perspective, what looks to us like arrogance is to them confidence, which is to say, why should they have to change anything? You know, from the perspective of Mars, they have engaged in this generations long terraforming project. They've engaged in this generations long effort to catch up and overtake, in fact, Earth in terms of technological capabilities. And everything that happens right up until the start of season four should suggest success on their part. They now have superior technology, particularly in the military side of things. They were never threatened by the Eros incident in the way that Earth was. And they now have a peace treaty with Earth after UN ships fired on each other, no less. And so from a Martian perspective, the very fact that they're engaged in a sort of drawdown of their military forces shouldn't to them necessarily be that disruption, because after all, they're Martians. Everything they have touched so far has succeeded, and indeed seems to be succeeding. And this is where confidence leads to arrogance. And indeed, we've seen their arrogance in previous seasons. Think about the Doniger incident in season one, in which, you know, this is like the, I think the second episode where the Doniger is now dealing with stealth ships from Jules Pierre Mao. And literally the captain of the ship is legitimately shocked that they're losing, because to her, it's inconceivable that anyone could actually be better than Mars. And similarly, they only secure peace with Earth because the captain of the Hammurabi in season three makes a really brilliant decision in retrospect, you know, not to fire on the Agatha King, thereby allowing, you know, realizing that, that in fact, and avoiding what would be a more general scale war. So, you know, this is the natural tendency of rising powers. It's to extrapolate from past trends. It's to assume we've been kicking ass so far. There is no reason to believe that we won't kick ass going further and cope with anything that comes our way. And of course, that overlooks the point that sometimes what looks like an inevitable, inexorable rise to hegemony or to great power success or so on and so forth is in fact the acme, and it's all downhill from here.
I was going to say something about Mars turning into a kleptocracy, but that is obviously not quite it. But I'm curious if there are parallels, because this is what I understand the Martian political situation to be. I think you're right that the top of the government does not realize that things are falling apart, right?
Right.
Or degrading. Falling apart is not quite it, but this...
Right. And to quote Bobby, Mars is changing. It's not dead, not yet.
Right. And then I think you have this vast, basically everyone below them, seeing that Mars is changing and kind of coping with it in their own ways. And human nature being human nature, one of those things is going to be to take whatever opportunity comes to make some profit.
Right.
I think that when you have a culture that's so focused on a singular thing, and that singular thing becomes... Well, you actually didn't mention the ring gates in your little discussion, right?
I didn't, because this is where I don't know if I agree with what the show is saying.
Right, right.
The ring gates introduce the idea that there are plenty of habitable worlds out there, worlds that no longer need generations of terraforming. Ergo, couldn't it just be possible for the Martians, you know, to not stay on Mars, to go to one of any of these other, you know, plenty of worlds, and set up shop under a blue sky?
So if you have a society that's so singularly focused on this generational project, that generational project kind of goes poof, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're then have no purpose, right? Then if you only have the singular thing, then once the singular thing is gone, then what are you going to do? It's sort of an argument, right, for a much more pluralistic society.
Because it's an argument for a society with pluralistic goals.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. I think that actually we are seeing in Bobby like a representation of Mars as a whole, right? It's not so much that she loves crime.
No, she clearly doesn't.
Right. It's that, well, what am I going to do? One of the things we talk about is that she seems to take to her crime family as though it was a Marine unit. Like, she wants to have that same sense of purpose, that same loyalty. She takes risks for them that probably, like, it doesn't really make sense that she takes them, because they're probably not as loyal to her as she is to them. But I think that that's what's happening in this vast middle strata of Mars, is that just people looking for something.
Right. I think that's true within the context of the show. I mean, first of all, you're right. I mean, but this is where Bobby really does perfectly capture the larger existential crisis, for lack of a way of putting it, that Martian society is facing. I mean, she talks in the first episode about the way that, you know, how are you so brave? You know, she has this conversation with Alex, and Bobby says, you know, the key is to believe in something so much that you don't necessarily think about the risks of what you're doing. And this leads to her, you know, in the end, this entire season for her is finding something to believe in, a purpose larger than herself. And as you say, at times it involves the crime family, to the point where she really literally does risk her life to try to facilitate a crime. And then in the end, as the in the last episode when she talks to Lily, where she says she's going to hang around, but she's actually legitimately happy because she says she's finally got something to do.
Right. Let's hear your theory about why this is wrong, or at least with your understanding of international relations and history, you think that the way that they've portrayed the Martian kind of struggle for purpose to be to say something is ahistorical in a science fiction context, I guess, doesn't make sense. But
no, that really is not fair. But let me put it this way. If you are drawing from history, if you're drawing from politics, I guess the thing I question is whether or not the singular, the culture of terraforming, which literally that's what Bobby says in one of the episodes. And in some ways, the most interesting conversation in terms of Martian politics is the one between Isai and Bobby, in which Isai talks about the idea that he was a good Martian as well. And that the phrase good Martian is shot through this entire season, in which it's referred to, Bobby is described that way in one of any number of times. And Isai describes himself as a good Martian who nonetheless now thinks, what's the point of all of this? And I guess the point that this is where I would take Bobby's side, where I don't know if the culture would change that quickly. The fact is that if terraforming has taken generations already, it is not clear to me that large a slice of Martian society would immediately go to, oh, well, now we can just leave. Now we can go to one of these other ring worlds. In no small part because, again, this unity of purpose would lead them, I think, culture doesn't change that quickly is the way I guess I would put it. And identities don't change that quickly. It's really hard. These are slow moving things. And so I don't blame the Martian government for necessarily thinking, well, this isn't that big of a deal. And in some ways, this is where fictionalized narratives are sometimes useful because what we're seeing taking place over the span of maybe like a year tops, less than that, I think would take much longer in the real world, as it were.
Yes. Like I was going to say, let's just say that it's compressed for the purposes of the show. Yeah. It's not exactly inaccurate. It's just greatly compressed.
It's not just compressed. The other thing that I do wonder about, I mean, clearly what Isai says in one episode in particular is that his fear is that the best and the brightest are no longer going to go into terraforming or into the military, that instead they're actually going to go elsewhere. They're going to go, try to explore new worlds, as it were. And I wasn't sure that that was actually the case. It would strike me that those who would tend to go elsewhere to become explorers, sometimes it's the best and brightest, but more often it's those elements of society that feel oppressed where they are currently. Think about the settling of the United States, for that matter. It mostly consisted of religious or ethnic minorities that felt they were oppressed elsewhere, at least in the sort of traditional narrative. And it would make sense that those would be the ones that would be willing to take what is a relatively perilous journey at the time and what would seem like a perilous journey in the world of the Expanse. If you were relatively successful on Mars, it strikes me as unlikely that you would want to leave it.
Except I think one of the background pieces that doesn't get explicated completely, so we're just making suppositions based on what we know of the show, is that the Martian economy is also somewhat undermined by the opening of the ring gates. That it was like it was an artificially inflated economy because of military and government spending. Mm-hmm. It was a Keynesian.
Right, this gives rise to Paul Krugman, as it turns out, we've discovered is a fan of The Expanse and wrote a blog post for The Times saying, clearly what Mars is suffering here is from secular stagnation because they're no longer engaging in massive military spending and so forth, and they should engage in a larger project as a way of sustaining economic growth. And this is where I suffer from, just to explain to listeners, you are a reader of the books. I have not read the books, so I don't know if there's any more information here. One of the things I wanted to know about was literally how the Martian economy was organized, because I got the sense that most of it was state-run rather than sort of private sector, which might be contrary to the Texan roots, but not necessarily to the elements of trying to, terraform an entire planet. So one of the things I kept wondering was, is that if you see a reduction in state investment, should there have been a boost in private sector investment? But the other thing is that if you really don't need to spend as much money on the military, if you're Mars's government, what you should have done was taken that money and doubled down on terraforming.
Yeah, because you're right. Like, some people aren't going to want to take that very, still very dangerous and long journey to other planets, right, no matter how attractive they may feel. Your mention of groups that feel marginalized being the ones, yeah, that might be most likely to leave made me think about who we've seen of Martian society. I, too, do tend to think this is an incredibly thoughtful show and all the decisions they make mean something. I think most of the sort of upper crust people we've seen on, not upper crust exactly, but the leadership roles we've seen on Mars, the elite we've seen on Mars, are all white.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which is not representative of Martian society at all. Martian society is polyglot and pretty, you know, from pretty diverse backgrounds.
It's true, although it should be noted that the criming gang that we mostly deal with is also mostly white.
Well, I might argue that's like they think that they can get away with this because they maybe this white privilege still exists on Mars. The other thing I wanted to suggest or ask, actually, is that I wondered if there is a parallel between this sped up Martian society, Martian government kind of degradation and a post-Soviet breakup Russia. Mm-hmm. Because, again, just to give people kind of a hint, not spoiling anything, but something that might come up, let's say, is I wonder if one outcome of losing that singularity of purpose might be some people turning to a kind of nationalism.
Dun, dun, dun.
Has that happened in the past, Dan? Because that's why, I mean, because I think of the Soviet Union, because that's sort, that is, I mean, obviously, what has happened in Russia. Like, they got more Russian, right, after the breakup. But I know it's different, but I'm just wondering what you think.
Oddly, the analogy I would use now is to less, I mean, this happened in Russia. There's no denying that, particularly in the sense of when once Vladimir Putin becomes the head of Russia, he invokes a much more nationalist ethos as a way to sort of supplant the ideology of communism. But there is another country that there are a couple of other countries that are doing this right now, you could argue, which is both China and the United States to some extent. If we're not going to put too fine a point on it, which is to say that generally speaking, when great powers start worrying about decline, which you've certainly seen in the United States over the last, let's say, decade or so, and even in China, which, you know, you have seen happen to some extent, even though the United States still thinks of China as an economic juggernaut, you know, China's growth rate is fallen dramatically from, let's say, 2000 over the last 15 years. And there's evidence that their productivity growth is much less and so on and so forth. And so it would not be shocking that they're turning to nationalism as well. As a way to sort of, you know, find something to sustain the legitimacy of the government rather than just delivering public goods to the people.
And I just realized I'm not actually giving much more of a hint than the show itself gave, which is what mm-hmm. that Martian officer says when he right before he kills himself in the Belter ship. He says the dream of Mars is not dead.
That's right. And that it was sort of the question I did have, you know, watching. Let's put it this way. The impression I got is that, you know, one of the things we learn is that clearly Marco Inaris clearly has some sort of relationship with someone relatively high up in the Martian government. And the assumption I had was that that was not necessarily an unapproved relationship, that I assumed that there might have been some conscious doings by Mars's government there rather than this being a rogue operation. But I have not read the book, so I'm just guessing there.
Well, I think that, yes, I think that even someone who's just seen the series like can take those things, what the Martian officer yells, and yes, I think the hints that Marco is working with an official government, you know, person, an official conduit, I think you could get to the question that I had. Let us board the Rossi and journey from Mars to Earth, which, much like our Earth, is having an election. And you and I both are fascinated by the, by the differences between that election, the elections we know here on Earth, And I think to introduce people to what is happening on Earth, we're going to play some campaign ads that were dropped as bonus content by Amazon. They're a little hard to find. That is why we're going to play them for you.
In the past century, Christian of Asarala and leaders like her have made the Earth more crowded. They have taken away opportunity. They have told you that they know how to live your life better than you do. Why would anyone want a future that looks like the past? Humanity is on the edge of its greatest step forward. The Ring Gates are the change to make a new and brighter future. And Nancy Gao is ready to lead the way. Vote Gao for Secretary General.
For an authenticated copy of this message and full financial disclosure, please consult United Nations Election Services.
I'm a working man. I've got a kid and wife, a little place of our own down near Austin. I don't really think much about politics, Mars and the belt and all that. It was just outside my experience until Eros happened. That was an unreal day. Everything I had, everyone I loved, could have been wiped away because of something so much bigger than us. I'm not ashamed to say I was scared. We were all scared. Times like that, you can see who your leaders are. Christian Abasarala was the shield who protected us. She will always have my vote.
For an authenticated copy of this message and full financial disclosure, please consult United Nations Election Services. Nancy Gao pretends to be just like you and me, but is she really? Her family pulled strings to win her a lottery position that could have gone to any of us. If Nancy Gao stole your spot, you wouldn't even know. We need honesty in our government. Christian Abasarala's family has a history of service and sacrifice that goes back generations. Nancy Gao has a history of cheating and jumping the line for her own benefit. Who do you trust to look out for you? For an authenticated copy of this message and full financial disclosure, please consult United Nations Election Services.
The wisdom of all the great traditions says we should have faith, for great things are coming. Earth has suffered for generations, but we have kept faith in a better, wider, fuller future. A place where no one's kids go without. Where the things that have kept us down are lifted from our shoulders. And our faith finds its reward. That future is here. And Nancy Gao is ready to lead us into it.
For an authenticated copy of this message and full financial disclosure, please consult United Nations Election Services.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So I think those ads laid out the platforms of our candidates pretty well. I do love them. I love how, I guess politics hasn't changed that much, right?
Except apparently facts are now verified by the UN.
Yes. Well, I want to talk more about that. We're going to talk about some of the differences and similarities.
Sure.
Are there any other details that seem relevant to you, Dan?
I think the Earth plot mostly pivots around Abasarala and her trying to essentially take on a new role. She's always been someone behind the scenes at the UN. She's always been someone who's been very good at being behind the scenes. And now she's the power on the throne rather than the power behind the throne, or behind the resolute desk, however you want to put it. I would say that the plot basically is a tension between Avasarala's deep concerns about what, let's say, the protomolecule might be doing on Illus or so on and so forth, and the worry that there would be another Eros if they engage in full-blown colonization. And at the same time, the political imperatives she is facing to campaign and to actually win the election against someone who is, frankly, a very good candidate, someone who's a better candidate than she is. And so she resorts, in the end, even though it seems like she hasn't been listening to her advisors, she resorts in the end to scaring the shit out of people by basically leaking evidence that there were bad things going on in Illis, and therefore maybe she was right in terms of pursuing a precautionary approach to colonization. Except as it turns out, Holden, the envoy that Avasarala sends to Illis, solves the problem on Illis, thereby creating a problem on Earth for her. So as it turns out, she loses not just the election, but potentially her marriage, because Arjun, who is her husband or her wife, however you want to
Yes, we've decided that those things describe roles, not gender. So
exactly.
Yes.
There's tension, I think, still residual between their relationship. The events on Earth end with Avasarala getting the message from Bobby that there's something rotten on Mars.
I would add one other background point, which as book reader, I can tell you, going to get more important. And the thing, and also the show tells you, I think, or telegraphs, you should pay attention to this, which is the threat of terrorism from radical OPA factions against Earth.
Right.
At one point in the season, Marco hurls a ship at Earth, which Avasarala has to make the decision, the 3 a.m.-ish decision about whether to shoot it down or not. And she decides to shoot it down. Which
was the right call.
Which was the right call.
One of the things that happens in this season is that Avasarala's decision-making competence degrades a little bit. She goes from making that decision, split second, to destroy the ship, which probably is the right move, to making a more disastrous policy decision, which is to engage in a high-risk operation to board a ship where she thinks Marco and Aris is on, but in the end winds up being a trap that kills all of the Marines that were sent there.
Hence, Pizgazi. Yes.
Yes, Pizgazi.
Well, those plot points having to do with Avasarala and terrorism and the mistakes that she's made behind the scenes or not behind the scenes, like those are things that are laying the groundwork for future plot arcs. You and I got real focused on the election.
Yes. I have a thesis on the election, which you might disagree with. I don't know. But the thing I have concluded is that Nancy Gao should have won, goddammit.
Oh, I think that from what they gave us, sure.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if she's like, yes. I mean, we both love Avasarala. She does seem like the stronger candidate. I mean, you always think we're going to disagree on stuff. And I think it's.
That's true.
Based on what you think my politics are, which you're probably correct. but in this particular fictional episode, I can just say she was definitely the stronger candidate.
Yeah. But and by the way, this was one of the things I actually really loved about this season on Earth, because for lack of a way of putting it, we've seen Avasarala almost never make a mistake in the first 3 years, I would argue, of this show, which is not to say that she's a perfect character. She's obviously a flawed character. It's the best part about The Expanse. They're all flawed. But in terms of her policy instincts, they are extremely good. And one of the things I liked about this season is that essentially we see her slightly, I'm going to say, out of her depth a little bit. You know, we see that in the form of the political debate where Gao is clearly the better debater than she is, even though she's not bad. It's just that she's not quite, she doesn't quite have the same sort of sure set of instincts. And also the parallel to American politics, I would say, is that all else equal, and I said this before, but it's worth bearing repeating, that the parallel to American politics is that all else equal, most Americans don't care about the rest of the world. And so they're not going to vote based on it, even if unless the threat is absolutely omnipresent, unless it's like, you know, a serious kind of, you know, height of the Cold War and or height of the War on Terror sort of instance. By and large, the American public care about bread and butter issues, you know, and cultural issues for that matter, in terms of at home. And one of the things I did like throughout this season is how whenever you see any discussion of those kinds of issues, you know, whether it's the lottery system to get a job on the in the UN or the grain shipments between different zones, Avasarala tunes out. She clearly doesn't care about it, and she clearly doesn't think that those are the important things. But this again is why she should have lost. Those are actually extremely important things. We as sci-fi enthusiasts obviously do care about the larger issues as well. But in that sense, The Expanse gets the politics right, because ordinary voters would care much more about those things. And that's where Gao is clearly the better candidate.
And that's why when she is able to release those very scary photos from Illis, her poll numbers go up, right? Like, if nothing else had happened, if Illis had remained scary and that very present threat, then she probably would have won. She would have been a wartime president. Right.
Right. She could have. I suspect she would have squeaked by in that instance. That's probably
okay,
true.
Now let's talk about we talked about polling and elections there once, but let's talk about that. The polling numbers just made me laugh every time they came up, because I was like, polling is already really, really hard. It's gotten more difficult as our society has changed and our technology has changed. There is right now a very active debate among pollsters about how to best represent the American populace. Right, Dan? I'm not making that up. That's like...
No, you're absolutely not.
And it has to do with cell phones. It has to do with what demographics do you use?
It also has to do with response rates, which is, it used to be, simply put, it was much easier to, in the brief heyday in which polls were done by phone call, with landlines. Usually the response rate, if someone was called, was on the order of like 30-35%. It's now less than 10. And so this leads to questions that we would call in the social science business selection effects, which is, are the people who are answering the phone a little bit different from the ones who don't? And does that lead to a skewed sample?
Are there shy Avasarala voters? That's what you want to know.
Yes, exactly.
Another deep cut for people that follow this stuff. I guess I sort of assumed, for the sake of the show, that everyone has one of those screens, like even people who are on BASIC has one of those cell phone PDA-like devices.
Right. I assumed, I mean, literally everyone has one that we see in the show. Like even the belter, even the poor impoverished belters all have those.
They're probably very cheap. You know, I mean, at this point, that kind of technology is probably like, you can give it away.
The other supposition I would make, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, because again, you've read the novels, but in some ways, this goes back to the ads, where in the ads you played, it made it very clear that the information and the statements and so on and so forth, there was some UN screening body that verified the content of the ads. Yeah, the information in the ads. My conclusion would be that it would not shock me if there is also a singular UN polling agency. And that might actually mandate answer. They you know, so that the parallel to Earth in the world of The Expanse, I think, is not, even though it's nominally the United Nations, which makes some sense because it's an extension of what we have now. I always sort of think about it as the EU. And so in some ways, I think of it as Eurostat engaging in polling of its, you know. And so as a result, it would be an authorized poll, which means presumably the response rates would be up. Also, the other thing is, if it is true that in this world half the population is on BASIC, as you put it, to put an awkward point on it, they have plenty of time to answer polls.
I was also wondering, in some countries, voting is mandatory, right? I wonder if there might be a imposition of polling being, but although that would be weird, because that'd be like voting. It'd be like just early voting. No, it wouldn't. You have to answer the poll question, right?
Yes, or there could be like some small reward if you answered a poll question, which is often how it's done now, by the way.
Huh.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So as it turns out now, in a lot of social scientists, when they, you know, the political science and in particular, but also economics, has turned towards doing a lot of survey work. And one of the ways in which you incentivize people to take surveys is something like you have a chance to win like $100 gift certificate at Apple or something like that. So you offer some tiny incentive that allows people to answer or incentivizes people to answer questions. It's the Vernon Smith, who won the Nobel Prize in economics, I believe, referred to it as the induced value theorem.
And then the other thing we should touch on, or I would like to touch on as far as Earth elections go, we mentioned in a previous podcast, but I think worth bringing up again, which is this verified by the UN stamp. Instead of hearing, I'm Christian and Vassarala and I paid for this ad, at the end of the ads, you hear this, you know, UN verified, da, 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 da. I think there's a barcode that flashes on the screen. And that is how you and I both assume that they address one of the most pressing problems facing, you know, democracy today, which is disinformation, trolling, voter manipulation, deep fakes, because those things right now, like if you do, draw out what it would look like 200 years from now, democracy doesn't even look functional. So those things would have had to have been taken care of in some way. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, are there any actual proposals like this? Do you know of anything that resembles the kind of system that we kind of have to guess what it is, but it's not too hard to imagine, right? Like it's some approval agency in the UN that approves ads and verifies them.
So the thing I would have to assume is that we've shifted to a world of public campaign finance.
Oh, God. Thank God. It has to be.
Right.
Yeah.
So one would assume that in addition to public campaign finance, there were probably that along with public campaign finance came other prerequisites in terms of accepting that money, which is if you're a candidate and you take that money and, you take that money, it also means you have to take all the obligations that come with it, which presumably include things like, I would assume, having ads fact checked by a UN fact checking agency and so on and so forth. In terms of whether that exists now, just quickly, the public financing of campaigns might exist. And certainly most other countries have blessedly shorter campaign cycles than the United States. But I don't know if there's anything along the lines of the fact checking.
Well, I was just wondering about proposals even. I wrote a long piece about fact checking for the Columbia Journalism Review that did look at, in some countries, actually, ironically, well, maybe not ironically at all, maybe completely logically, the U.S. is now becoming a minority or an outlier in terms of how we do our fact checking. A bunch of other countries, especially those that are emerging democracies, let's say, in South America and Eastern Europe, have government-funded fact checking, where it is a news, like there are journalists that have been hired, and they have some kind of public fund. I shouldn't say government, but public funding to do fact checking.
Right. And they have some sort of public legitimacy, which means that if they issue a fact correction or so on and so forth, then presumably that would affect the larger population. That's entirely possible. I mean, the truth is that right now in the United States, there's no way that would work, mostly because
I know
trust and authority is much lower. So you'd have to see some change in terms of public attitudes for something like that to emerge. And I'm not sure how comfortable I would be in that emerging, if for no other reason that one of the things that the world of the expanse doesn't deal with is, well, what about other ads? In other words, is it just the Avasarala campaign and the Gao campaign, or are there affiliated groups or what have you? And this is where the United States is such an outlier that I don't think it's actually a good template to think about how the world of the expanse operates.
My assumption, based on some conversations I've seen by creators of the show, is that there was a climate catastrophe so bad on Earth that a lot of the neoliberal thinking that sustained politics in the United States got swept aside as though by a tsunami. That is how you get to universal basic income, for instance, and a much more EU-like attitude towards government, probably.
With also, to be fair, EU-like problems.
Right. Yes, exactly. That, for good or ill, our somewhat cowboy individualist way of looking at government stopped working when the climate did, which explains a lot of what I think of what looks like super progressive policies, progressively in terms of a political point of view, that are enacted on Earth. And I think that's an interesting, it also maybe answers a little bit of the question about Mars and what it looks like and how politically possible or not possible a basically state-funded economy would be. That if they're coming from Earth, even if they're, especially maybe if they're displaced by climate change, they are much more open to a centralized economy than people who haven't experienced capitalism fucking everything up.
It's true, although this then gets to the question, as you say, that it was, if you think of Mars as Texas-led, Texas has a, slightly different relationship to capitalism, I would say. Not state unfriendly necessarily. I mean, there are ways in which under Rick Perry, Texas Texas's economic development actually had a significant state role.
And I was, and Texans are practical people too. You know, if it seems like something's not working. Mm-hmm. Why not?
You know, you got to fix that. You got to fix that sucker.
So I think we have ended our tour of the inner planets.
I think we have.
Do you have anything you want to say about looking forward to season 5 and what interesting political problems and situations we might expect?
So obviously, as I said, I'm kind of curious to see who the deep dark is when we look at Mars and what's going on there. And I think the other thing I will be very curious about is I assume we're going to see Ava Sarala continue to play a leading role. And the question is, what is Ava Sarala's role as a former, as it were? Presumably she will soon be an ex-UN Secretary General. And we can think about the relationship or the ways in which former policy principles, their role is... I think it's Harry Truman that once said, you know, they're statesmen. And you know what a statesman is? A statesman is a dead politician.
Since I do have the advantage of having read the books, I don't want to get into the political problems and situations that may come up. I've already said too much. But I do want to say something about the character development that I think we're going to see, which is, of course, the pairing of Christian and Bobby, which
I am looking forward to.
Well, they've already been paired once in the past, right? When she hired Bobby to be her bodyguard. I think it might get even more interesting when both of them have lost a little bit of their central mojo, right? They're both looking.
They've both experienced setbacks.
Right. So I'm interested in seeing how that goes. And of course, I'm interested in seeing more of what outfits she wears. But I do mean Christian there. Bobby seems to really favor a certain, let's say, uniform look.
So the aesthetic question I was going to ask you, I do want to see what Ava Sorrell is going to be wearing. What is your prediction for Bobby's hair next season?
Half up, maybe? Like a...
Okay. Because as you brilliantly pointed out, for season 4, you know, Bobby's hair was a perfect predictor of what was going on, you know, underneath her, which is to say that when her hair was pulled back in a ponytail, as it were, it was clear that she was sort of, you know, the good Martian, whereas it became looser the more she began to do crime.
All right. That is it for this part of the season recap, the inners. We're going to be doing a part 2, which will drop, you know, the next episode. Dan, would you like to say goodbye?
Goodbye, Anna.
Goodbye, Dan.